This is Radio Influence, podcasting redefined.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Tennis with an Accent, our debut show with our partners, Radio Influence. And I'm joined by my co-host and partner at Tennis with an Accent, Matt Zemek, and Andrew Burton, who also has been an integral part of Tennis with an Accent. He was at Cincinnati covering the event for us. Welcome, guys, and let's preview this U.S. Open draw.
Thank you, Saket.
The draw is out. The cat's out of the bag already. We are a day late, but I think still the excitement is in the air, and the podcast is probably much awaited. So, Matt, let me just put you on the block right away. Is there a first week or first round story that's in your mind and that you think should be the first talking point on this show?
Well, there are a number of really good choices. And if you were to look at the women's side, you know, you would probably choose Caroline Garcia and Jo Konta. But for even more star power, I have to look on the ATP side and that first round match between Grigor Dimitrov and Stan Wawrinka. It's notable in and of itself, but it's also notable because this was a first round match at Wimbledon. And the stakes, you know, are very high for this match. One big reason from Grigor's side of the divide is that he just lost a big pile of points in Cincinnati, and he's going to be losing a bunch of points in London at the ATP Finals because he's not likely to get there. He's way behind in the race to London. So if he wants to have any chance of getting back to London and making an effort to defend those points so that he doesn't continue to sink further in the rankings, he needs a big U.S. Open, and he's not defending very many points since he bowed out of that tournament early last year. He lost to Andrei Rublev. So this is a huge, huge match for Grigor Dimitrov's 2018 season. That is not an overstatement in any way, shape, or form. So that match certainly has my eye. And as I turn to you, Andrew, you know, you were in Cincinnati, and you got to see Stan the Man Wawrinka make his way into the quarterfinals against Roger Federer. When you look at Stan's side of that match against Grigor, what will you be looking for? What are some of the keys Stan needs to keep in mind? And what is your overall view of this U.S. Open for Stan, given his summer hardcourt run-up to this event?
Well, both Dimitrov and Wawrinka play in Cincinnati. Stan is a lot further on than he was 3 months ago. One of the things that I wrote about in Cincinnati was that there were three players, Wawrinka, Murray, and Djokovic, who'd been at the top of the men's game and were all embarked on comebacks. Murray went out in the first round. Wawrinka, as you said, Matt, got to the quarterfinals playing much more confident tennis than he has in a while. He had a great win over Nishikori in the second match he played there. I arrived at the stadium in time to see him bouncing his racket a bit grumpily off the court, having gone down 4-1, and he reeled off seven straight games that taught me that if I get grumpy on the court, bouncing the racket is obviously the right strategy to follow. Stan, I think, took a lot of confidence from that win. He lost to Federer, but he was 2 points from victory at 6-6 in the second set tiebreak. Federer prevailed, came through relatively comfortably in the third set. I think Stan thinks that his game is on the right track, and we'll see where he is by the end of the year. The third player, obviously, who's on the comeback trail, went all the way to victory there, which is Novak Djokovic. And I think we can now take Novak off the comeback trail. He's come back. Wimbledon, a Masters 1000, I think you can say he's come back. So Dimitrov against Wawrinka. Stan goes into it as the unseeded player. Grigor has a top seed. I think that if Stan won, you wouldn't call it an upset.
Absolutely, Andrew. And given that you, now moving away from the Wawrinka-Dimitrov match, but staying with first week storylines on the ATP side at the U.S. Open, because you were in Cincinnati, you also got to see and write about Nick Kyrgios, one of the more enigmatic figures in tennis. You wrote a very incisive piece, and I'd like you to just, for our listeners who might not have read your piece, your portrait of Kyrgios, I'd like you to just briefly explain what you went into there, and then from that, you can then give our listeners a sense of where you see Kyrgios's game at this point. But first, tell us about the piece that you wrote for Tennis with an Accent in Cincinnati.
You know, I based it around some conversations that I listened to in the media room in the first few rounds in Cincinnati. I'd been at the match where Kyrgios took on Dennis Kudler, the American, and they got again to a final set tiebreak there, which went beyond 6-6 all. And at 8-7, Nick faced match point and hit 134-mile-an-hour second serve ace, wide second serve ace, eventually won the tiebreak, I think 11-9. And some of the people in the media room were almost scandalized that Kyrgios had hit that serve at that point. It was, you know, these things just aren't done. And Kyrgios would go out to Del Potro. I watched that match as well. I found it was the first time I'd seen Kyrgios play live as opposed to on TV. And, you know, there were a couple of things that I took away from it. One is that he genuinely is one of the most interesting players to watch because of the sort of almost anti-percentage play he has. I said that it's percentage play if you use imaginary numbers in percentages. He will pull off shots that you don't think should be attempted, and then he'll attempt shots that really should not be attempted at all. He has an amazingly live arm on the serve and wins tons of free points and just has his opponents just almost shrugging their shoulders. There's nothing that I can do. But obviously his approach to the game is completely different to the classic Australian style. And the reproach that is in people's voices towards Kyrgios, to a certain extent, when I listen to him speak in press conferences, it sounded like a very gifted person, but sometimes the way that people would talk to a gifted 8-year-old or a 10-year-old. And there's almost this sense that Kyrgios is not seen as or treated as a adult tennis player. He's treated like a wayward child. So that was the sense that I had listening to people in the press, listening to fans, and almost listening to Nick himself, the way that he was replaying things about his effort level, about his discipline, that it sounded like he was channeling the way that people around him talk to him. So he's a storyline for the US Open. He's drawn potentially to meet Federer in the third round. And it'll be interesting to see if both of them get there. And if they do, that's a night session match for certain. But tremendously interesting talent, but also someone who is seen in a very, very different way to almost any other tennis player.
Let me follow up on that, Andrew. Given Kyrgios's identity as an Australian and given the rich heritage of the Australian old guard, Rosewall, Laver, Roach, and all those guys in the 1960s. Is the fact that Kyrgios is from Australia something which magnifies his deviation from the old school ethos? I mean, is there something about tennis journalists in a press room that latches onto the old Australian tradition as something which magnifies the extent to which they feel scandalized that someone would dare hit a 134 mile per hour second serve? Is there an extra something you sensed in Cincinnati, or that you just simply sense in general, which gets at least to an extent, probably not fully, but at least begins to explain why journalists react to Kyrgios the way they do?
I think that might be true in Australia. I'm not sure that that's true in the United States. And if Nick were American, then I think people's responses to him and reactions to him might be a bit different. But I think that certainly within the Australian tennis world, you have a couple of very talented players. Nick is younger than Bernard Tomic. But Tomic is someone who I think went out in the first round of qualifying at the US Open. Certainly, I'm pretty sure that he didn't make the main draw. And Tomic is seen as someone who came up, had a lot of attention paid to him, but then again didn't embody the classic Australian ethos. So I'm pretty sure that Australians are looking at Tomic and Kyrgios and saying, you're not like the guys that we were used to. With Kyrgios, I think, I mean, another thing that I didn't mention was that physically, he's dealing with what are apparently a number of chronic issues. So one reason why he might not make the third round at the US Open is that he was struggling physically Cincinnati, and by the third set against Del Potro, you know, you might have thought that he was tanking. And I think, again, some people look at Kyrgios and are very quick to jump to the conclusion that he's potentially tanking. But there were a lot of times where he wasn't running for balls, and that he was relying on his serve to try and keep him in the match. So the Australian side, I think, matters in Australia less so perhaps in other areas. Some of the other things that have been around Kyrgios, the racket smashing, the incident with Wawrinka a couple of years ago, those are things that he still hasn't gotten beyond. And I think that there's a lot of, if you would just focus on your tennis, then think about what you could be. This is something I think he's hearing from all kinds of different quarters.
So Matt, on that note, is there any particular story, actually not peculiar, any exciting story on the women's side of the draw, which, you know, excites you as far as the matchups go? I know there's a potential Williams clash in the third round, but before that, let me ask you, what do you think of the Sharapova-Ostapenko matchup that may materialize as well?
First thing to note about a potential Sharapova-Ostapenko match, and of course, they have to get through two matches apiece to even get to that point. But if we have that match, it's worth recalling that in Rome, they played a quarterfinal over 3 hours in length. Sharapova won 6-7, 6-4, 7-5. The first set tiebreaker was 8-6. So that was a match played on the razor's edge the whole way. And it was one of the slugfests of the WTA clay court season. And if we get anything close to that in this reunion, fans are going to be in for a treat. The main thing that comes across really with both players, and of course, you know, Sharapova is in a very weird space, you know, still trying to find her footing coming back from the suspension. Ostapenko, age 21, trying to find her sea legs on the WTA tour. Though they are nearly 10 years apart, they are both exhibiting a lot of the same patterns reflective of a lot of the WTA tour. We're going to get into that later in this conversation, but so many WTA players are immensely talented, but that immense talent, while producing some quality results here and there, is not producing season-long consistency. So Sharapova and Ostapenko are both in the same boat in that regard. You know, Sharapova had a very encouraging French Open, got to the quarters. Ostapenko didn't do anything at the French Open, but then she made the semifinals of Wimbledon. So you don't know what to expect from either player from tournament to tournament, but you do know that within an individual tournament, both players are capable of making deep second week runs. So it's very much a wild card kind of match. One could say that since Sharapova narrowly pulled out that Rome quarterfinal, that she's going to have the mental edge. But on the other hand, that was on clay, which has become Sharapova's one reliable surface at this stage of her career. This is not going to be on clay. So it is a true toss-up from many angles, and that's part of what's going to make it such an interesting watch. So that's one of the potential blockbuster third-round matches on the WTA side. And now, Andrew, I want to turn the next one over to you. Serena, Venus, the U.S. Open, their history is well-documented. And, of course, they are in very different places this year compared to last. Serena, of course, wasn't even playing. She was dealing with childbirth. But Venus has a very different 2018 compared to her resplendent 2017. What are your general thoughts on a Serena-Venus third-round match at the Open?
Immensely attractive prospect, but both players have to get there. I think Venus has a tougher draw. She's got Svetlana Kuznetsova in the first round. And then if she gets through that one, possibly faces Camilla Giorgi, who is a genuine threat on her day to any player. But if we do get a third round matchup between the two, then Serena, I think, was pretty unfortunate to go out in one of the matches of the tournament to Petra Kvitova at Cincinnati, and you wouldn't bet against her, I think.
Anything that you saw in Cincinnati of Serena and also Simona Halep that's worth passing on to our listeners? Any observations you gained from their respective games? I know that Serena didn't last very long in the tournament, which didn't provide really a large sample from which to draw observations. But what if anything, did you pick up from what you saw in Cincinnati?
Hard to really tell with Serena, because the quality that I associate most with Serena is being able to find a way to tough out hard matches. And we talked a little bit before about people in the ATP side who are making comebacks. Serena is in that category, and she hasn't yet found the most Serena-like quality, which is being able to find a way to get through. Even when she's not at her best level, so many of the tournaments she wins are not at her base level, but her best quality of all is finding the way to be the one waving to the crowd at the end of the match. So nothing more to add than that. Halep, I think, just ran out of fuel in Cincinnati. She had match point against Bertens in the final. She'd have done the back-to-back double of Canada and Cincinnati. Didn't quite manage to do it, but assuming that she goes into the U.S. Open, rest, and then gets the every other day schedule that you get in a Grand Slam, she's looking awfully solid and a potential, you know, long range WTA number one. Although Kaya Kanepi in the first round is potentially a tough out. So sometimes Halep has started the Grand Slam tournaments a little bit slow. And I would hope, for her sake, if she's going to establish herself as a long range number one, that this isn't one of those tournaments.
Okay. And, you know, we're going to talk about Simona Halep a little bit later in this conversation. We talked about a number of first week storylines at the U.S. Open. So now we're going to focus on Halep a little bit later, but a number of other players who figure to be in the second week conversation. And so to start off, I'm interested, Saqib, in your impressions about Alexander Zverev. You know, he has yet to make his first major semifinal, and many feel that this U.S. Open draw gives him a good chance to check that box on his career resume at age 21. The big news is that he is now partnering with Ivan Lendl. It's official. You know, Lendl has joined Team Zverev for this U.S. Open. So what should we expect, if anything? Of course, this partnership is very new. What are some of your foremost insights about the Zverev-Lendl partnership in New York?
I think it's the second biggest partnership after we joined forces with Radio Influence. That was a bad joke, but yeah. I think Lendl, these rumors have been on card. I remember when I had come back from Miami, that's a rumor that was circulating on ESPN and Twitter and, you know, whatever the networks were talking about, because there was a Lendl sighting then. And then there was, not too long ago, I think before the hard court season started, there was another picture of Lendl and Zverev practicing somewhere in Florida, but both parties declined that there's anything concrete to it, was just a practice. And now at US Open, I think as a qualifying week started, this was official. And now I think Zverev has spoken in press. So this is intriguing because we've spoken, I think, at length in the past on this podcast and even on our Twitter exchanges. Of all the super coaches, I think Lendl was the one who was very instrumental. I know Djokovic and Becker are, you know, that was a very solid partnership, but Marin Vida was always there. That's something I've maintained, and we can even dig the archives. I said that, even though Becker was one of my favorite players of all time. I think Djokovic was a proven guy, so they just took him to another level, who's already won 6 majors, so he won 6 more. But Murray was the unfinished piece in that puzzle, who had lost, I think, 3 finals when Lendl came on board in 2012. And I think that's the kind of excitement and anticipation this partnership has, because Zverev, at his best, is one guy who rose to prominence when Djokovic was having his injury related last year, and he did beat Djokovic and Federer in Masters 1000. So he's increasingly, knocking, close to knocking the door. He bought Juan Carlos Ferrer last year, but Lendl is definitely steps up from that kind of a coaching arrangement. It'll be very interesting. And I think it's also benefits Zverev that the rise of Djokovic, and it's all about the big three all of a sudden, because these are three guys who won the last 3 majors. So Zverev might just come in as one of the few guys who has a chance. But I think the storyline focuses on the other three may just help him. And Lendl, I think, is a master of, getting things done. And he was always a guy who didn't get the media love. So I think he can also mentor Zverev in so many other regards. But again, this US Open is the first of their partnership. Or maybe you both can chip in too. I'm not sure if we'll see, Zverev standing on the second Sunday holding the trophy. But I think we'll see something that, changed in Murray drastically, because in 2012 Australian Open, after winning Brisbane, Murray and Djokovic played one of their best matches. And Murray, I think, was the most aggressive in that match. And that probably set the tone. And Sasha Zverev is definitely not known to be defensive. So I'm going to just see how important the first week is. If he doesn't spend much energy, he can be a factor. He's going to be playing, I think, Marin Cilic if they both get there. I think that'll be the first test. But I'm very excited. I'm not putting much hopes right at the US Open. But I think this is a much-needed step for, I think, the arrival of Zverev to the very next level. Because I've always believed it's only a matter of when, not, if. So,
yeah. So Saqib, let me ask you a follow-up. Lendl, in the 80s, one of the ways in which he changed men's tennis was the emphasis on the big forehand in combination with the serve. I mean, the 1-2 tennis, that's something that Lendl helped develop, and he was better at the U.S. Open than anywhere else, making 8 straight finals there. So given that, Zverev's money shot has been the backhand, and he's needed to beef up the forehand, and when one realizes that that was also a challenge, not the only challenge, but a challenge with Andy Murray to beef up his forehand and to know when he can be aggressive with it. Do you see that, Saqib, as the central thing that Lendl needs to develop in Zverev's game beforehand, or is this more a case of reshaping either the mental game or certain other tactical approaches? What are your thoughts on the Zverev forehand and how Lendl can have a part in that?
I think we've talked to our good friend Mert, and he's been the expert, so I'm not going to give my wisdom here. I'm going to just reiterate what we've spoken on the podcast before. And he thinks Zverev, certain times his second serve goes away, especially when break points are crucial games. His patterns are predictable. And then his sideways sometime movement for the forehand is also becomes predictable or safe. Or, those are kind of things that I have observed also. But at the same time, to me, again, I'm more a novice compared to like Mert. So I won't even really qualify to give opinion. But I think Zverev is very close to being a finished product. And Lendl brings a lot of those X factors. He already has a killer serve, which is at least the first serve. It can really, stay with the best. So I'm thinking more again, Matt, along the conversation that you've had in the past against Zverev or that work against Zverev, which is his scheduling and the energy he spends in the first week. Now he has the French Open quarterfinals in the bag. So, he doesn't have to talk about that his record in best of five is not that good. So I think Lendl will bring certain calm, and I'm sure technical adjustments, and those adjustments I think vary who you play on a given day. So I think it's just a matter of taking that best of three and that mindset, which Zverev is known as a champion on the ATP tour. I think Lendl will just help him solidify his reckoning as a contender for these big events. And I think till Murray cements his place back, Zverev is the official fourth member of that club right now. I know it's short term. He doesn't have the pedigree of those guys in terms of achievements, but purely in terms of game, I think it's between him and Cilic as the fourth member of that. So maybe you guys can disagree here if you are putting Zverev or Cilic. That's a counter question for you both. Andrew, you want to take a stab at it first? Who's the number four favorite in the men, according to you?
We haven't mentioned Kevin Anderson yet, who's another player who's begun to get to the latter stages of tournaments on a regular basis. But I don't have Zverev as the deep threat yet, precisely because of the point that you made earlier, which is that he hasn't yet worked out how to get through the first three or four rounds dropping one set or fewer. It is really hard to win Grand Slams. It can be done, as Federer showed in the Australian Open in 2017, playing several five-set matches. But that's something that Zverev regularly seems to find himself using up a lot of energy in the first week. And even in Cincinnati, to my eyes, I was watching him play against Robin Haase. He won the first set 7-5. I said to myself, well, that one's in the bag, walked away and showed my forecasting abilities, because Haase came through that in three sets in the round of 32, the first match that Zverev played. So I just don't trust Zverev yet to have shown that he can consistently that he ought to beat in three sets. Matt, what do you think?
Well, I know, Andrew, that you've said I will give my opinion shortly, but I first want to say that you have mentioned about Zverev that you don't think that he's the full meal deal just yet. And I'm assuming that refers to just the inability to make his way through first weeks of majors efficiently. But is there any other piece to the Zverev puzzle that tells you why he's not yet the full meal deal?
It really is. Let me just go back to the comment I made about Serena Williams earlier, that at the end of the day, what counts is being able to deliver the wins. And when I look at Zverev's overall game, Saqib talked about the second serve, the first serve. He gets a lot of velocity, a lot of free points. He's got very good ground strokes. He has a tendency to retreat behind the baseline and play further back from the baseline than I would expect the dominant player to play. He can volley. He's not yet a natural volleyer, so he's got the tools. But the thing that I think that you have to do to be able to consistently go deep at Grand Slams is to win the matches comfortably that you're expected to win. And then the matches that are tough matches, you find the right way to take on the opponent on the day.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent set of observations. And to give you my thoughts on Zverev very quickly, he takes the scenic route. Consider what he did against Tsitsipas in Toronto. You know, that was a routine match up until the time came for Zverev to serve out that match, and then he flinched. And of course, that was a best of three match and not best of five. But we can look back to the French Open, where he complicated things against Lajovic and Zoomer and Khachanov. You know, he could have made those matches much more routine than they were. So in that, one can find a penchant for making things very complicated. That's one thing. The other thing to note about Zverev, as I've written about multiple times over the summer during Washington, Canada, and Cincinnati, Zverev is right now, just at this point in his evolution, he's very conscious on building up stamina and strength and resilience. And he showed those things at the French Open. So he has that down. But I think in his desire to show physical stamina, he gets into a mindset of wanting to grind. And that mindset of wanting to grind takes him away from being able to win points as cleanly and efficiently as possible. So in that sense, there is still a very real way in which Zverev is still finding himself. And so to kind of get to Saqib's point, and also just to, you know, answer your question, Andrew, I think that Cilic knows how to win a point very directly. You know, Cilic reduces tennis to its essentials a little bit more regularly than Zverev does. You know, big serve, sweep the ball to the corners, let's not mess around. I think that Cilic is more comfortable finding different ways to win a point and finding quicker ways to win a point. So if you had to ask me whether Zverev or Cilic will win a potential quarterfinal, I would go with Marin Cilic at this point. So speaking of ATP quarterfinals, and again, shifting topics, the biggest quarterfinal of the whole tournament, not just the men, but men or women, is Novak Djokovic against Roger Federer. And of course, they both have to win four matches to get there. So let's not count our chickens before they've hatched. But if this is a U.S. Open preview, we obviously have to consider the possibility. So this will be the first time that Djokovic comes to New York on the heels of a Cincinnati win. He won Cincinnati for the first time. So this will be a new experience for him. It'll be a new headspace. And meanwhile, Roger Federer is licking the wounds of what was a very decisive loss. Now, Andrew, you were in Cincinnati. You saw that final. You wrote about it. You were in the press room with Djokovic and Federer multiple occasions during the week. From everything that you've seen, and of course, having studied these players for years, going beyond just what you saw during that week in Mason, Ohio, size up for us a Djokovic-Federer quarterfinal, and what things viewers, when they watch that match on television or perhaps in the stands in New York, should be looking for.
Yeah, let's cast our imagination forward. Let's assume that both Djokovic and Federer are fit going in, and neither of them has, you know, had to battle through four or five set matches, and you know, they take the court, you've got the warm-ups going on, and people look back and say, well, Djokovic trounced Federer in the final in Cincinnati, which is, I think, the best way to describe it. I'm hoping that Severin Luthi and Ivan Ljubicic, who is Federer's coaching partnership, finally persuade Federer to take some return practice, which he's famously said that he doesn't do, because in the final against Djokovic, but also in the semifinal against Goffin, there were times where Federer was struggling to get returns into play. Goffin, as we later learned, had a shoulder injury, was serving 10 miles an hour slower, and still Federer was struggling to get returns into play. Federer eked out a first set tiebreak against Goffin, and then sort of walked to the net to accept a handshake because Goffin retired in the third game of the second set. You might have thought, well, okay, that was just an off night on the return after having played two matches the day before, but then Federer took on Djokovic and you know, basically laid an egg in that match and came into the press. And I got to ask Federer the first question at the press conference, and in a slightly more polite fashion than this, I said, well, why was your return so awful? And he didn't disguise it, took it on the chin, as it were. But then during the press conference, as it happened, Federer, you know, I could watch him in the course of about 5 or 6 minutes, which was the time that we had for English questions, and then about 5 or 10 minutes, which was for French and Swiss German questions. You saw Federer do what great players do, which was put a defeat behind him and put disappointment behind him. He came into the press actually straight off the court after the trophy ceremony, still in the kit that he'd been wearing. And he came in feeling very disappointed and upset. And then by the end of that press conference, you know, he had filed it away and moved on. So I think that if he comes into the match having won four matches and playing Novak in a five-set match, what happened in Cincinnati is going to be yesterday's news. He won't let that affect him. Now, what Federer also spoke about in press was he doesn't think he's a favorite to win the tournament. He sees Novak, who won in Cincinnati but also won Wimbledon, and Rafael Nadal, who won in Roland Garros, won in Toronto, and then skipped Cincinnati, giving himself a chance to recover. He sees both of those guys as pre-tournament favorites. So even though I think Federer will put that match beside him if he does play Djokovic, I think he recognizes that the Novak's game isn't quite all the way back to where it was in the 2015, early 2016 period. But Novak's head certainly is there. Novak won 4 three-set matches in a row, one of which he wasn't feeling terribly well, where he played Adrian Mannarino. But then he battled back against Grigor Dimitrov. He battled back against Raonic, and he came back from giving up the second set against Cilic, and in a very hard-fought third set came past Cilic. So Djokovic now, I think, believes that, again, he's got the winner's mentality there. So neither player is gonna quake from that encounter if it happens. But again, it's going to be a different encounter than it might have been earlier in the season. Federer showed in Cincinnati that I think he can get tired a bit more easily than he has in the past.
Matt, let me ask you a question on what Andrew said. I think there's some very useful information that Andrew presented here. I know Federer and Djokovic hadn't played for 31 months. This was talked about at length on Twitter and every forum. But before that, and now the Cincinnati match, Federer has lost three matches in a row: Australian Open final in semis in 2016, and the World Tour final in 2015. I know those matches are quite removed, but this match also has a very mental history. You know, like, they're both competitors, and a lot of time they both have had runs against each other, even though a lot of people think this rivalry has been very evened out. But they have had spells when Federer dominated, then Djokovic dominated. So do you think, Matt, that Federer, if this match does materialize, would go in knowing that he has lost the last three, or the other two matches are distant memory?
I think the other two matches are really a distant memory. I think this is very unique space for both Federer and Djokovic within the context of their rivalry. You know, when Federer won the 2017 Australian Open, that was a case where, not having played Rafa in 3 years, Federer found a reset button, and it's a reset button that he needed, you know, just to focus on hitting the ball, to block out some, if not all, of the context, the subtext of his rivalry with Rafa. And he definitely gained that extra measure of clarity he needed to play that fifth set well from 3-1 down. So with Federer and Djokovic, that rivalry has not operated the same way. I mean, they have, as you accurately note, taken turns, but they've really traded punches more than one person having a consistent upper hand the way Rafa did over Roger. So I don't think that Federer didn't have something to prove in Cincinnati, and to be more precise, it was Djokovic who had something to prove, not necessarily against Federer, but just because he wanted to win Cincinnati for the first time, and he had lost to Federer in three previous Cincinnati finals. So that was unique in that it was not so much the opponent, because Djokovic had, you know, beaten Federer in their recent matchups last time they played. It was more a matter of Djokovic wanting to master a specific situation of winning a Cincinnati final and clearing that hurdle in his career. So I think that they come at this in a very different situation. One thing I'd like to ask Andrew as a follow-up on this topic is that, you know, we know very well that Stan Wawrinka, to reference another Swiss player, enjoys the best of five format because it's very spacious and it gives him extra time, extra room and margin to play his way into form in the first week. And now, you know, and Andrew, you raised the point about Federer being fatigued a little bit more than he used to be. So that invites what comes across to me as a very fascinating question. Does Federer need a first week which is very, very smooth, or could he actually counterintuitively benefit from having a tough scrap at least one of his first four matches before he gets to Djokovic, assuming he's able to get that far? Where would you stand on that question?
I'd probably go with a tough scrap, I think. I mean, I could imagine a Federer-Kyrgios match that goes four sets or longer, again, assuming that Nick is fit, and then the sense of, okay, I'm really seeing the ball well, and I've come through a contest. However, the last few times that they have played in five sets, Djokovic has prevailed. He four sets, I think, in the Australian Open semi-final, which was the last match Federer played before he was injured, and Djokovic in the first two sets there looked absolutely majestic. They played a four-set US Open final and a four-set Wimbledon final in 2015, and they played a five-set Wimbledon final that was a superb match in 2014. I don't think either of them are going to be quaking in their boots about the match, but I think in the longer format, Djokovic has been a much more likely winner since the last time Federer won, which was in 2012. Federer has tended to get his wins over the best of three.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Okay, so we've talked about two members of the Big Three. We can't forget about the third member of the Big Three, and third not in the sense that he is third in order or quality, but just that we haven't talked about him yet, and that is Rafael Nadal Pereira, the defending champion at this U.S. Open. And I'd like to start with Saqib. You know, last year, and it's very interesting to point this out, last year in Cincinnati, there was also a lot of rain delays, and there was a backlog schedule. You know, this year, Federer played two matches in the same day. Last year, it was Rafa, among a few others, who played two matches on the same day during his Cincinnati campaign. He came from that situation in Cincinnati where he lost in the quarterfinals to Kyrgios, and he came to New York and he won the whole ball of wax, winning his third U.S. Open title. So this year, Saqib, Rafa skipped Cincinnati. And I think in light of all the rain that there was in Cincinnati, it was a good decision for Rafa. He probably would have been miserable after his championship week in Toronto. He got rest and relaxation. But we also know about Rafa that he likes being able to work his way into a rhythm. So will that week off in Cincinnati, even if it might have been a wise decision under the immediate circumstances, do you think that will leave him at something of a deficit in New York such that it'll take a little more time for the wheels to get turning for him?
It's hard to say, I mean, with these kind of things, because if you follow, you know, the sentiment regarding the Nadal, you know, fan base, all of them have been kind of like pleading or requesting that, you know, they know the man really wants to play more and that's how he finds a rhythm. If he has an easy match, he hits a practice court. But a lot of people think for longevity and how much he gets out of his body during the clay season, you know, those huge runs, you know, his standard is so high there, you know, he plays for the final or, you know, he wins them all. So I think on that note, people have expected him to, like, you know, cut short his season. And I think, like, he answered this question in press today. He said he took the week off from competing, but he was practicing and still, you know, working out on his game. And it wasn't really a week off. So, and then I think it's an interesting point too, Matt, because after Australian Open, Canada was Nadal's first hard court event, and he won that in a very good fashion, because he did get challenged through the likes of, you know, I think Wawrinka in two very close tie breaks, I believe, and then Cilic was a better man for the first set and a half, or at least the first set. So Nadal, it's not like there was a cakewalk. He really went and played some good tennis and met some resistance, and then, you know, had an easy time against Tsitsipas in the first set in the finals. So on that note, I think he probably is also tinkering the idea of longevity, because he's someone who's been perennially hurt, and his knees have, you know, have a direct correlation with at least what he says for hardcore tennis. So I don't think he's coming in any compromise that this will derail his momentum. This is new ground that he doesn't usually miss Cincy, but he got a title under his belt, and last time we looked, he looked pretty solid. And the draw also has helped, you know, some of its you know, ways to for Nadal's benefit, because I know Nadal probably doesn't take a match lightly. He'll give his best, but I think there could have been some difficult matches, which are now on the through the players that are living in the other section or other part of the draw. So I think the draw gods have been slightly kind. And like I said to you in the radio show, that Djokovic was the overwhelming favorite. Now I think with Nadal's draw, that gap has been bridged, because Djokovic still might have to go through a very tough second week. He might have to go through Federer, Zverev / Cilic. But Nadal has to battle maybe, you know, Karina Busta team or Kyle Edmund and Kevin Anderson, you know, before he plays Del Potro, if he does get there in the semis. So I think, I don't know if I answer your question. I think week off is something new for Nadal, but then the draw kind of does, you know, help him, you know, span his wings and, you know, play into form if he does have a bad set in him in the beginning. But I don't see anyone in his section troubling him.
Andrew, I'd like to ask you about Rafa. And Saqib mentioned toward the end of his answer, you know, a possible semifinal against Delpo. Now, this year, we're not expecting Delpo to get the flu and then come back from a two-set deficit against Dominic Thiem in the fourth round and then beat Roger Federer after facing a set point in the third set and turning around that quarterfinal. It's going to be hard for Delpo to create a similarly dramatic path to the semifinals, but the U.S. Open is clearly his best and most successful major. And he did get eliminated by Nadal in the semifinals last year. So I know that we're, you know, looking ahead, but hey, that's part of previewing a 128 player tournament, that we explore different scenarios. If we get to a Nadal Delpo rematch in the semifinals this year, Andrew, is there anything you think that Delpo can realistically do to change the equation against Nadal, knowing what's gone before?
I think it goes to tournament form, to be honest. Del Potro is one of the players. Cilic is another. Wawrinka at his best level. who can make his way through one or more of the ATP players that we call the big three. I think his game and Nadal's, if Nadal is in good form, possibly Del Potro's game matches up best against Federer's, then possibly Djokovic's and last against Nadal's. I remember watching the two men play in an Indian Wells final, and that was a scrap. Nadal came out on top there. So if you were playing that match 100 times, Nadal would win it 75 to 80 times, and Del Potro the other 20 to 25. And, you know, if you're listening, you can fill in your own numbers if you want to. So most of the time I'd expect Nadal to come through, but if Del Potro is fit and playing well, then he's got a definite puncher's chance.
Okay, so we've talked a lot about the ATP the past 20 minutes or so in this conversation, so let's shift it back to the WTA, and since we are focusing on, at this point in the podcast, second week storylines and second week possibilities, that would include a possible clash early in the second week, the fourth round, between Simona Halep, the world number one, and Serena Williams, a player who knows a thing or two about how to hold on to number one for a long time and act like number one for a long time. So that sets up a very neat conversation about staying power on the WTA Tour and how to become great and remain great. Serena's proved it. Simona is trying to prove it. And it says a lot about the WTA's search for stability among its top players. So, Andrew, I know that you have discussed this point in various ways. Unpack some of your thoughts about the ebbs and flows of power and consistency on the WTA Tour, with Halep obviously embodying that search at this U.S. Open.
Well, there's a number of terms that get thrown around a lot. One of them is depth, in terms of the ability of players ranked 40, 50, 60 or so to play real high quality tennis. Another one that doesn't get used as much is one that I like, which is stability, which is how often you expect to see the top players in a tour making their way to the business end of tournaments. What's really interesting to me is that in recent years, it's something that we associate with the ATP and the term Big Four, which is one more than the Big Three. So Big Four, including Andy Murray, there's been a period of time where you expected to see three or even four of those players at the semifinal stage in the big tournaments. But on the WTA side, that was the pattern in the early 2000s. You had players like Capriati, Hingis, Clijsters, Davenport, along with the Williams sisters, who were perennial candidates to finish at the semifinal or the final stage of tournaments. So these things go in waves. One of the things that is so remarkable about Serena Williams is that she was one of these players who was competing in multiple finals and holding up the trophies in the early 2000s. I think her last really significant rival, who she would expect to see at the business end of tournaments, week in, week out, was Justine Henin. And then after that, in the last almost decade, Serena's been waiting for someone who she would expect to see competing with her in the semifinals or the finals. Now, Halep potentially is beginning to establish herself. Angelique Kerber in 2016 was competing in several finals, but then had a difficult 2017. You've got players like Muguruza, who's competed in finals but seems to be a bit more volatile. So I'm waiting to see, and it's not something that we'll learn in the US Open this year, but over the next 2 to 3 years, whether the WTA establishes itself as a tour in which players like Sloane Stephens or Madison Keys or Karolina Pliskova become the players that we expect to see each time that there's a Grand Slam tournament competing in the semifinals or the finals.
And Andrew, following up a little bit here, when we consider various players, WTA or ATP, who have that volatile nature, Stan Wawrinka being a good example on the ATP side, who, might not be there every single major tournament, but when they do well, they do it big. You know, they make a final and in many cases win it. There is a debate among a lot of tennis fans. At least I can speak from experience from just interacting with people on Twitter for, almost a decade now. A lot of people will tell me that, if you're not winning the big tournaments, that if you have a lot of semifinals over the course of a season, it's not that great a commentary on a player. I mean, it's certainly a good thing. It's certainly admirable. It does represent a certain degree of stability, but you're not bagging trophies. A good example would be Petra Kvitova has a large stack of titles in 2018, and whereas Simona Halep does not. Halep has planted her flag on basically making the semifinals of tournaments nearly every time. So within that debate between the person who's making a semifinal almost all the time, but not consistently winning titles, compared to someone like Kvitova, who is so good at winning tournaments once she gets to the quarterfinals, but who doesn't regularly get to the quarters or semis of tournaments, where do you sit in terms of evaluating those two basic and very different overall templates for tennis players and their results over the course of a season?
I'm trying to think about an ATP equivalent, because I'm blanking at the moment, but someone I think asked, so would you rather have Stan Wawrinka's career or Zverev or...
like Zverev.
I was thinking of a Burdick or Ferrer, someone who was typically competing in quarterfinals or semifinals, but Stan, when his game is on, is someone who can bulldoze his way through a Federer and a Djokovic in the same tournament as he did in that famous French Open win. And for me, ultimately, if you're not lifting the trophy a few times at the end of the tournament throughout the year, you don't place yourself with the elite players. But then if you're Stan, then you're maybe one rung or so below the elite players, in the sense that when you catch fire, you really catch fire. And in this era, 3 Grand Slam tournament wins, and he may yet do more, that is something that 4 players currently in the ATP know what that's like. So Halep, I think, is potentially, we can have this conversation a year from now and see if I'm right about this, but Halep, I think, may be moving from a really, really talented player who doesn't quite know how to close the deal into someone who does know how to close the deal. Possibly the nearest equivalent to Stan on the women's side is Sloane Stephens, who came, for me at least, almost out of nowhere to pick up the US Open last year and is the defending champion. But then she got to the final again in Roland Garros this year and just got outlasted by Halep. So Stevens is able to go deep again this year at the US Open and also evolves into one of these players who we look at in a few years and say, it's fantastic to see how stable the WTA is and when is the ATP going to get its act together.
Yeah, that really helps flesh things out. I think we can generally agree that, you know, if you're someone such as Wawrinka with three majors, even within a context of overall career volatility, that does set you apart from, say, Cilic, or for the WTA, you know, Halep and Wozniacki, as long as they are sitting on just one major title. And that if either Halep or Wozniacki or some other one-time major champions on the WTA Tour, if they got to three majors, that we will definitely look at them in a very different way. We're winding down our podcast, and we're gonna offer our championship match predictions. Who's gonna get there and who's gonna win? But before that, I just want to go around the table on some players that we have an eye on in New York, people that we're curious about or interested in. I'm going to start out by just saying that, you know, whereas Simona Halep has climbed the mountain and has won a first major title, and Wozniacki did the same earlier this year at the Australian Open, we now come to another player who has celebrated her 26th birthday and is looking for a breakthrough. And I thought that at the beginning of the year, looking at WTA players in their mid-20s, but on the north side of the mid-20s, moving toward age 27, 28. I thought at the beginning of the year we were going to think about Karolina Pliskova, but she has receded in the WTA's power structure. And, of course, she made the very curious decision to, you know, having had Renee Stubbs as her new coach, she then made a substitute and will work with Conchita Martinez at the U.S. Open, but then will rejoin Stubbs after the U.S. Open. So she's kind of in a place where she's searching for a winning formula. But the other 26-year-old who is emerging on the WTA Tour is the Cincinnati champion, Kiki Bertens, who survived that match point in the second set tiebreaker against Halep. And won the match in three. She was the fittest player at that event. She outlasted Kvitova in a three-set semi, outlasted Halep in a three-set final. So to me, in terms of players that I have my eye on in New York, Bertens stands out in that she has had this steady rise over the summer. Wimbledon quarters, she had never gone that far before. Had her unprecedented Premier 5 title in Cincinnati, the biggest title of her career to date. Is she going to keep climbing, or, as we have seen with other WTA players in recent years, and I think of Caroline Garcia running out of steam in 2018 after her surge at the end of 2017, can Bertens consolidate this momentum and with a good U.S. Open showing, and she has a good draw, can she establish herself as one of the foremost players on tour going into 2019? So that's my player to watch. Saqib, who is a player that you have your eye on in New York? And then after you, we'll throw it over to Andrew for his selection.
I'm very keen to see how Steph Tsitsipas builds in a major now. He reached the round of 16 in Wimbledon. And if we look back a year ago, he lost to Nico Mahu in the last round of qualifying on a very muggy, humid day at Corona Park, and he looked spent in that match. And he's really a different man. I think physically he's grown into someone who many of us, including myself, I didn't think he had this kind of a high this early. He has reset my expectations pretty much on a weekly basis. And now he has lost early in Cincinnati. Will give him much needed, I think, 10 or 12 days rest. I think he's really, his forehand is his shot. Even though his backhand is very picturesque and he's not afraid to come to the net, he dictates, you know, with his forehand. And in a lot of ways, you know, he dictates on the forehand like Federer, unlike Dimitrov, who usually gets compared. But I'm not trying to enforce a comparison here, but that's what I just think. And I'll be very keen to follow Tsitsipas during this week. And let's see if he can build on the good work he's created this far by advancing to another second week of a major. Over to you, Andrew.
So I learned this afternoon that there is another popcorn match in the ATP first round match. It's a Canadian double. Two of the younger players on the circuit, Denis Shapovalov and Félix Auger-Aliassime. And that's one that potentially 4 or 5 years down the track, we may be seeing in finals. So whoever comes through that one, I think Félix has a lovely all-round game. I think Denis has a really interesting attacking style, which is quite rare these days. The ATP is more of a defensively weighted tour. So whoever wins that one is my one to follow on the ATP side. On the WTA side, I loved Sabalenka. She's superb personality, really interesting. She's number 26 with a bullet. She's not in a ghastly part of the draw, so it'll be quite interesting to see if she can make her way through to the second week.
I'm just worried, Andrew, that she's in the New Haven final against Carla Suarez Navarro. I'm just worried that all the weeks of tennis might leave her a little depleted. But I do think that Danielle Collins, who's been struggling, that's a good first rounder for her. All right, we are closing in on the end of the podcast, so it's time for predictions. And of course, if I say to clip the red wire to defuse the bomb, that's probably a good indication that you should clip the blue wire instead. But nevertheless, we're going to venture our predictions, and I'll get us started off. WTA, I have Sloane Stephens over Angelique Kerber. If you look at Sloane Stephens' last few majors, she won the U.S. Open, lost in the first round in Australia, made the final at Roland Garros, lost in the first round at Wimbledon. So I guess it's time for her to make the final again. And I think that if she does, that she'll have that roaring New York crowd behind her and that she'll beat Angelique Kerber. Men's side, it's going to be predictable, but sometimes if you have to predict what is predictable, you should still do it, at least if you think so. So I will take Novak Djokovic over Rafael Nadal in the final. Saqib, how do you see this tournament turning out for both tours?
For the men, I think I agree with you. I've tossed around different matchups. I think the most likely scenario before the first ball is being hit is Djokovic over Nadal. So I'm going to second you there. And the women, I think I'm very intrigued by the potential Halep and Serena match. Whoever wins this, I think will have a huge impact on the draw. The heart says Serena, but right now the mind is leaning towards Simona Halep. Like Andrew said, I think she has transformed herself from a credible player to, I think, a champion. And I think she can win her second major of the year, and she'll beat the Wimbledon finalist, Wimbledon champion Angelique Kerber in the finals. Andrew, what are your picks?
On the WTA side, I defer to others who are much more expert than I, except that randomness has reigned in the WTA for a while. So I had Garcia against Pliskova in the final, and Andrew Murray's long stated prediction that he was looking at a future world number one starts to come true this month with Garcia making Flushing Meadow French for a day. And in the ATP, I think that one of the players who contested a final 10 years ago, actually 9 years ago, makes it through again. I have Del Potro making it through on the men's side and taking on a player who is 5 days his junior, Marin Cilic, who wins his second U.S. Open.
Wow. 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 That's my full response. Wow.
All right. There you go.
So, I would like to conclude this podcast, and I'll pass it over to Saqib for a few final words, but I want to tell our listeners that due to our partnership with Radio Influence and on Twitter at Radio Influence, on the web at radioinfluence.com, you can follow our podcast on a number of different outlets now. Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, TuneIn, and RadioInfluence.com. So whatever service you have, or if you can only listen to us through certain outlets and your friends can only listen to us in certain outlets, you now have a lot of choices. So we are very happy to partner with Radio Influence for the Tennis with an Accent podcast. And Saqib, if there are any other housekeeping notes you want to offer before we conclude this podcast?
And just want to add to our regular patrons who have put our podcast on the map by supporting it for almost 2 years, the podcast link would still be available on the Tennis Accent homepage as an addition, which will take you to the Radio Influence site or whatever the platform you are coming from, either Apple or Google Play. And on that note, I would like to thank Matt and Andrew for this first show in this new partnership of ours. And hopefully we can record more podcasts in the coming weeks as this US Open unpacks into one of our stellar slams of this year. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.
This is the Landry Football with Chris Landry. Quick fix on Radio Influence.
Urban Meyer professionally had his cell phone professionally wiped. This is according to the investigators. Got nothing to hide. Can't remember anything. Well, it didn't take him long to remember that he had stuff on his cell phone he didn't want people to see. He had it professionally taken out. Yeah, it took a long time, 11, 12 hours, to come to some sort of a decision. Why? I truly believe that President Drake was not comfortable in any way, unless there was at the very least, a suspension, a statement. A little surprising to me. I didn't know how it was going to play out, but I thought, probably foolishly, that Urban just exercised bad judgment and he followed proper protocol and all that. And he might get time served, might get 2-game suspension, and that's that. The investigation clearly uncovered stuff that I didn't think. And I do believe now he could have been fired with cause and would have been fired with cause. Of course, that would have gone into litigation. But it would have happened had it not been Urban. The arrogance of Urban knows no bounds.
Chris Landry brings you Landry Football every week on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Play, and of course, RadioInfluence.com.